Accession number 30395, Mr. Barry Summerfield, Reel 9. Now, we were talking about this patrol, tank patrol, with the Royal Ulster Rifles.
That's right.
With, which you tell me now is was called Operation Commando.
Operation
so
Commando.
Can look up the date.
Yeah.
You know. Now, you just got to the point where you'd opened fire with a machine gun and reported the contact.
Yeah.
You know. Now, what happened next?
Well, once we'd reported the contacts, and the contacts had disappeared, then we carried on with the patrol. It was a little after this start that a quite amusing episode occurred. The order came through from the rear that we were to put the observation panels on the front of the tank. Now, these were recognition panels, fluorescent, which could be seen from a considerable distance away. The idea was that if we did bump into the American patrol that was supposed to be going parallel to us, then as they were prone to being a bit trigger happy, they would recognise us and wouldn't shoot at us. So I got out of the tank to put the panel in position. It was obvious I would have to do it, A, because I was the commander, and B, because to get the operator out would have been disrupting the crew, which wasn't a good thing. So I started to fix the panel to the front of the tank, and I turned round, and my gunner was out of my turret, and the wireless operator was out of his turret entrance, and they were swapping blows. They were at fisticuffs with each other. I think the strain of the day had that up to that point had been too much for them, and they just decided to have a go at each other. It was incredible. Here we are in the middle of action, and the two of them fighting. Anyway, we got that sorted out and carried on with the patrol. What I didn't know that was happening to the rear, that obviously other contacts were being made within the column. And it was at that point somewhere that the last tank in my troop, who was the troop commander, but was way, way out of sight for me, apparently won the MM. Yeah, Lieutenant Troughton, he won the MM there. Something connected with it. But because we were obviously doing what we were doing, we weren't involved in what other people were doing. We never did meet up with the Americans. We never did. And in the end, I think around about 3 or 4 in the afternoon, then we turned around, headed for home.
And was there a debriefing?
When we got back, quite a considerable one. Yeah.
What was that like?
It was fairly heavy, in so much as there'd been a lot of other things going on down the column, as I say, that we didn't know about.
Now, before we go on, you wanted to explain, you got this visit to Curie a bit
yeah,
wrong.
Yeah, no, I got it wrong.
You got all your time sequence a bit wrong.
Yeah, I did. What happened was, we arrived at Poussin, as I explained. That all went all right, and we went right the way through, exactly as I'll explain what was happening at Curie, and at some point,
You didn't go forward to the line at that time?
No. At some point towards the end of November, the middle to the end of November, they shipped the whole of B Squadron over to Curie in Japan on a Japanese old Japanese freighter. When we got there, we went down to Curie docks, and the ship that had our tanks was there. We unloaded all the tanks, and as I explained before, they were all covered in oil and everything, and were cleaned up, ready to go. We were then loaded onto rather large LCTs, American LCTs, and we were shipped up to Incheon, and that's where we loaded air squadron stuff. All the other stuff was still at Poussin, was loaded on at Poussin, and we actually met up with a train somewhere in Seoul, I think, and then carried on.
And
north.
Then went up
yeah,
to the border.
It. Yeah, that's what actually happened.
Now, so what else do you remember? You know, after this big commando patrol, Operation Commando, the patrol. Yeah. Any other patrols you particularly remember, or any other operations at that time?
No, they were all reasonably small patrols. You would go out as sometimes as a troop, but mainly probably as a double troop, going out on patrols and getting shelled by the enemy. That was a reasonably frequent occurrence. We could never fathom out how they, when you didn't see anybody, there was no obvious contact with the enemy, but all of a sudden, you'd suddenly be in the middle of being shelled.
What was it like being under shell fire? I mean, you hadn't had a lot of it, but what was it? How'd you feel?
Well, I suppose you were a little bit nervous. You know, you didn't like the idea of a 155 landing on top of your tank because you didn't know what had happened. If it did. I suppose it'd be stupid to say that you weren't nervous, because everybody with an ounce of intelligence would be nervous under those circumstances.
Anything else happened on those that kind of patrol, the minor ones?
No, funny things. I remember one time we went out with the Belgian battalion that we were in support of anyway. They were a good load of lads, actually. And when we came back, this would have been sort of midish summer when this happened. They just took their pay books and their papers out of their pockets, put them on the ground, and just dived in the river with all their gear on, everything. Didn't take anything off at all, just dived straight in the river, had a swim. Things like that, sort of crazy things that you did. We had to go in at one particular point. Funny enough, it was that patrol where it happened, where two guys had wandered into a minefield and got blown up.
What happened there?
Well, they were both porters, Korean porters, and they'd wandered into the minefield. I think it was Air Minefield, actually, but they'd wandered into it and got blown up. Somebody went in and got them out. That was it.
Now, where were you actually living, during this period? I mean, did you have a set base?
Yeah, no, we were still in Happy Valley.
We
never actually moved from Happy Valley.
And how did it develop? I mean, did it start to develop, more facilities, if you like?
No. It was still exactly the same. It never changed. It was just like a bloody refugee camp, if you want. that was it. What we managed to do, we tried, obviously, if we could leave the lean-to up, because we didn't have actually tents, as tents as such. What we had was the canvas that covered the tank was built up like a hutchie and attached to the side of the tank. And that was it. So what we tried to do was to untie it if we went out on patrol and leave it there so that when we came back, we didn't have to put it all up again. Yeah, funny things. For instance, one afternoon we were all laying on the beds because, it was summerish time. And a huge great snake about 6 foot long came down one of the tent poles and nearly frightened the life out of the guy when he turned around and saw it.
Were there many snakes that you saw?
We saw a few snakes, some very, very small that they said were quite deadly.
Is that the bootlace ones?
I don't know. I don't know what they were called, but they were very, very small. We did encounter those, and the big ones, which were apparently harmless, also saw a lot of deer. Quite a lot of deer there. But other than that, no. Because I suppose, you see, we weren't like the infantry. We weren't up in the hills very much. If we went up in the hills, we went up to have a look around, as soldiers, as it were.
Did you ever fire your main armament? I mean, or was it mainly just machine gun work?
No, it was mainly machine gun work. We went out on some patrols whereby we did long distance shelling.
Now tell me about that.
Well, the only thing I can clearly remember is we formed up on a hill, and there was the whole squadron, I think, was up on the hill.
Which hill?
Somewhere around the engine. And we were given contacts to shell, and we just shelled it. We weren't really, again, we weren't really aware of what we were doing. We were just doing it, but we didn't see any because it was too far away. We didn't actually use the main armaments a great deal until the Battle of the Imjin. That was when we used them mainly.
So, is that the next thing, or is there anything else in before that?
No, not really a lot. I think I went on R&R at that point.
Let's do that before you go on. Yeah, so what happened there?
Yeah,
Tokyo.
What they do is they ship you out just as you are, bang you into a lorry, and say, right, you're off for 5 days to Tokyo. They whipped us down to Seoul, which, remember, wasn't all that far away. That's the thing. People don't realise, I think, that Korea is not very big. You know, I mean, it's about 150 miles maximum at its width, and it's only about 400 or 500 miles long. It's not that big. And we were always very close to the capital, really. So we were whipped to Seoul Airfield, put on board, I think there were American planes. Big, anyway, they were big planes. And we were shipped out to Tokyo.
Was that your first flight? Would that be your first flight?
Yeah, I suppose it was.
Was it anything special about it? I mean,
I suppose because you're young, you know, you take it all in your stride. But I suppose it was quite a momentous thing to happen. I seem to remember that it was cold and it was very noisy. Because they were all turboprop aeroplanes. They were big. I think they would probably be the American equivalent. I think it was Douglas. They were the equivalent to Air
Dakotas.
Hercules today or something like that. They certainly weren't Dakotas.
Oh, right. They're bigger than that.
No. They were four-engine jobs.
Now, what happened when you got to Tokyo?
Well, when we got to Tokyo, we were... They really worked hard, you know, to get you to relax. So as soon as you got there, you're into this huge, great nappy, if it was a nappy. I'm not sure what it was. And then all your kit is taken off you. You just keep your papers with you. Your shower, deloused, everything like that. And given a brand new uniform and off you go. They sewed your unit flashes on. Everything was done for you. Everything was done.
Now, where were you staying? In this big nappy place?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it was like a hostel.
Was it comfortable?
Oh, yeah, it was lovely. Well, of course, anything would have been lovely under those.
Did you have your own rooms, or were you still in?
No, I think we were about four or five to a room.
Now, so what were you doing? Typical
get up and have breakfast, and then have a wander around the town. Try and see as much of Tokyo as you could. And then at night, of course, it was down to the Ginza and all the beer halls and everything. I mean, it was a wide open city because it was in the American zone for a start. So there was, from the point of view of money, there was no shortage of money there. The Americans had poured a great deal of money into Tokyo anyway. And they were also in the process of getting ready to pull out, in actual fact. Although I don't think they knew it at that time.
Did you drink a lot?
We did. Yeah, we laid it on. There was no question about that.
How'd you get on with the Japanese?
Oh, yeah, all right, basically. I mean, you've got to remember, we didn't have any axe to grind with the Japanese. We weren't Second World War veterans. So, I mean, we knew about the atrocities the Japanese had committed. I suppose, in retrospect, if you looked at it, you couldn't associate the atrocities you'd heard about with these people that were walking about in the streets. Because they didn't like the sort of people that would do that.
So, you were just there a week?
No, only 5 days. That's all. Yeah, everybody had 5 days R&R. That's what they tried to fit in.
Now, what happened when you got back? Is this where we move into the Battle of the Imjin?
Yeah, it must have been. We were coming on to that point.
So, when would that be?
April. And
Now, what do you remember of that?
Well, right, in the first instance, at that particular point, my troop was being seconded to the 1st Australian Regiment.
So that's... Was it still the same troop?
It was. Oh yeah, it was still the same troop. Still
so,
three
so
troop.
Three troop. Yeah. B squadron.
Yeah. I never left that troop actually, but we were being seconded to the Australian, and it was at this point where they started taking up positions on hills.
Now, which Australian unit do you know, or just generally?
No, it was the 1st Australian Regiment.
And that's infantry.
Infantry, yeah.
And how did that work?
Well. I suppose it would be a platoon would take over a hill, and the tank would go up the hill with them to support them from up there. That was the basic principle of the whole thing. The Australians dug in. I can't tell you how we got it. But we finished up with a sledge, which we could attach to the back of the tank. It was basic, just an ordinary basic wooden sledge. I can remember that was steel runners. We would do things like go down in the morning to the river, because we were alongside a river. Don't ask me which river, because I don't know. And we would fill up, take the some Australians down with us, and get the water for the day, fill up all the jerry cans and everything. Well, they would, while we stood guard on the side of the riverbed. And then they'd fill them up, and then we'd go back up.
At some so it's point, just water?
Just water at that point. At some point during the day, porters, Korean porters, would bring up food, ammunition, whatever.
Now, what were these hill positions like?
They were like little forts in a way. We dug the tank in.
Now, can you explain how you did that?
Yeah, well, you actually literally got shovels out and dug a hole, and then sort of with a ramp, as it were, so that the tank could go into there, and it was like almost like making a slit trench for the tank. You got it down as deep as you could.
But still able to fire.
Still able to fire completely. Oh yeah.
That sounds like hard work.
Well, I suppose it was, but well, we did it. That's it. I mean, you've got to remember. I think that most of these tops of these hills have been shelled anyway, so they're all pretty soft. At some point or the other, one thinks. This one, I don't think this one had been actually in a position of action, because there was an awful lot of growth on it, you know, green bushes and things like that.
Now, so they were in slit trenches around. Now, how did you get on with the Australians?
Okay, yeah, all right. We found them, I personally found them a little bit hard to come to terms with, because their sense of discipline is not quite like the British Army.
In what way?
They're very matey, you know, with the officers and the things like that. And like, they turn around, I think the officer's name was Chris, and they were all calling him Chris. I mean, that was unheard of in the British Army. But they seemed to, they certainly were an incredible fighting unit, there was no question about now, that.
What did you base that on? Or is that about what happened?
Yeah, well, that's about, you know, like, I mean, I don't think at that point the Battle of Cap Yong had started. I think the Battle of Cap Yong was after the Im Chim Battle. So it hadn't started, but you got the impression, you know, that they were good blokes to be alongside in the case of trouble.
So what happens? What happens next? Then? So you're up on this hill,
yeah, and
that's April, is it? Or have you actually got up?
Sometime or other, April, just about round about when the battle started, and then I don't remember ever firing the guns up there, because we never saw anything. And then on when the Im Chim battle started, we could hear a lot of noise over to the left. Now that was where that particular section was, and I think it started. There had been, over the couple of nights previous, there had been the odd attacks. Not on us, but on somebody over to the left. And we just knew that somebody was copping it over there, but we didn't know what it was. And then it'd be on the night when it started, I suppose, about the 27th or whatever it was, all hell broke loose. And the funny thing was, we never actually got attacked at all. Never.
No. It was a neighbouring unit.
It was it was where the Gloucesters, the Ulsters, and the Northumberland Fusiliers were. Now, we'd moved out, obviously, we'd moved out from there, from Happy Valley, so we weren't there. If we'd have been in Happy Valley, obviously, we would have got for it all. But I think, and I'm not 100% sure about this, but I think A Squadron had taken over from us, and we were then shipped over to the Australians, B Squadron, right? So, in actual fact, we never saw anything of the battle at all, B Squadron. And that, more or less, went on for about 3 days. We were pulled...
So, sort of the 27th to the 30th.
Yeah, that's it. We were pulled off of there and pulled back. And at some point or the other, on pulling back, we picked up an awful lot of the Ulsters. So we must have been fairly close to the Royal Ulster Rifles.
What do you mean, picked up?
Well, picked them up on the tank because they were walking. And they were obviously coming back from the battle and we didn't know it. We picked them up and took them back with us to where we were going, to our lager. But, of course, everything was very much in the air, you know. You weren't being told what was happening. You didn't know. All you got information from was actually the guys that you had on the back of your tank. And that was basically the only way that I knew exactly, more or less, what had gone on. We were pulled back then a considerable way, maybe 15, 20 miles. And then...
Where to? Do you know where...
We were going back to Saul again. But I think the thing was, at this point, there was no question about it. We were not going to go south of the river. We were going to hold the line there, north of the river. Which is basically what we did. And then, all we were doing, that I can remember clearly, was it was a series of small engagements from then on. You know, take a hill here. Always in support of one of the British units. We were totally, I think at this point, the Commonwealth Brigade had been formed. So we were, the Commonwealth Division had been formed. So at this point, we were now a division. We were a Commonwealth Division, and that was it.
Did that make a big difference to you?
Yeah, it did, in so much as you didn't have the contact with the Americans, you weren't involved with them, and you knew everybody you spoke to was one of your own officers. So it was very camaraderie, if you want. It was a very close thing. You were very aware of the fact that, you know, you were now a proper unit. I suppose up until that point, although nobody'd ever said it, you didn't feel like you were a real unit. You know, you didn't feel like you were attached to anybody.
Now, tell me about one of these typical local attacks. What would happen then?
Well, what would happen is you'd get an instruction that the following morning you'd be going into ATAC, A point, and the infantry were to take that point. They were all little hills. They weren't everywhere in Korea was bloody hills anyway. There was no flat. Not really.
And which units were you supporting?
Normally, 9 times out of 10, we would support the Ulsters. But there were other times when we went with the Northumberlands, for instance. And never went with the Gloucesters, so I think at that point the Gloucesters were being reformed.
Now, what was a typical local attack on a hill with these like?
Well, that they'd you take them as close on the back of the tanks as you could. Inevitably, this involved... So we must have been south of the Imjin, thinking about it, because it involved fording the Imjin. Remember taking them over on the backs of the tanks. you get them as near as to the starting point as you could do. And then,
how many could you get on the tank?
Oh, you get as many as 20 or 30 if you squeezed them tight and they held on tight. And you had to be careful, obviously. I mean, you were never going to go fast or anything like that. And then,
what was it like fording the Imjin? I mean, did you actually go across it or on a bridge?
No. We forded it. We found the original ford. What happened was one morning we were told, I was personally told to go down to the water's edge at a particular point and reconnaissance it, because they thought there might be a ford there. It might be shallow enough to ford. So I got out and I instructed the gunner to come out with me. And I said, we'll walk down to the edge from here. Oh, we passed some dead Chinese on the way. I don't know what they were doing there. Hadn't been buried, I suppose. And then we were walking towards it and I suddenly stopped and I thought, oh. And I shouted to the wireless operator to stand still. I realised we'd walk straight into the middle of a minefield. The reason I saw it was because I saw the wires and I realised what we'd done. So I just said to you, now step back carefully, don't tread on the wires for Christ's sake, tread over them and get back to the tank very slowly. And we did that. And then we just took the tank to the water's edge. We did find a ford there and we used it, I think. They all had names, these, and I think it was called the Ulster Crossing, that one, I'm not sure. But that was the one basically that we used, and the water would be up to about between 2 and 3 foot up a tank. So it was okay, you know.
It wasn't coming in then?
No. And that was that. And then, as I say, we dropped the troops off to wherever they would have their start line. And then, from then on, unless we received instructions from somebody else, the troop commander would be giving us targets to fire on. And
what with?
With the 20-pounders. Now, we were talking about the big stuff now. With the 20-pounders, and he would be in close liaison with the infantry commander. Now, sometimes it was by radio, but in a lot of cases, the infantry people were using the telephone on the back of the tank. Because, you know, you could see what was going on in other tanks, obviously. And then we would just fire on whatever target it was, trying to assist the infantry in taking the object.